Today is Monday, May 31st, 2010. I'm Bradley Pepink, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. As the clouds part in Vancouver and we hope to experience some sunshine this evening, we take a revealing look at the upcoming political conferences taking place at the end of the month in Ontario. The G8 and G20 meetings are expected to outshine the Vancouver Olympics when it comes to their security costs. With the Conservative government projecting a $1.1 billion bill to Canadians in order to cover the security costs for the meetings, News Director Andrew Longhurst examines what's happening in Ottawa following the declaration of this hefty figure. Speaking with Liberal MP Mark Holland, opposition critic for public safety, and NDP MP Don Davies, critic for public safety, Andrew delves deep into the late June meetings of heads of states. This in-depth examination will be preceded today by our weekly feature with Colleen Kimmett from The Tie. In our third of many future collaborations, she joins us over the phone to chat about some recent stories published on thetie.ca, the independent daily online magazine. With the ongoing crisis in the Gulf Coast, Colleen will guide us around the nation as the global impact of oil spills affect how Canadians perceive the natural resource. Lastly, we'll close off the show with this week's edition of Groundwire, grassroots news radio from campus and community radio across the nation. That's all today. That's all on today's broadcast for May 31st here on News 101, your source for community and campus news, and broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in what is currently sunny Vancouver. But to start things off, here are the latest headlines from Free Speech Radio News. These are a special holiday edition of the headlines as the United States mark Memorial Day today.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Relocation of the U.S. airbase on the southern Japanese island of Okinawa has been a major topic of dispute since the Democratic Party of Japan took office last September. Today, the Japanese government took a significant step to resolve the issue, but controversy remains, and a group of more than 150 protesters gathered in front of the Prime Minister's office. FSRN's Shuhei Nakayama has the details.
Japan and the United States have reached an agreement that the U.S. Marine Air Base remain within Okinawa. A joint statement issued Friday says that the current base in Futenma will be relocated to a less crowded northern part of the island, Henoko. The agreement is similar to a 2006 treaty signed by the two countries, a treaty that U.S. has been demanding be upheld. In signing the agreement, Prime Minister Yukio Hatoyama went back on his long-standing pledge to move the base off the island. In a news conference, Hatoyama stressed the importance of Japan's alliance with the U.S., mentioning the rising tensions between North and South Korea. Hatoyama also announced his decision to dismiss the leader of the coalition government's Social Democratic Party from his cabinet because she refused to sign the agreement. Shuhei Nakayama, Free Speech Radio News.
The Supreme Court of Mexico has ruled that states must provide rape victims with the morning after pill if they request it. Several Mexican states have restricted abortion access over the past 2 years, even for rape victims. This came in response to Mexico City's legalization of first trimester abortions in 2007. Thursday's court ruling forces all states to provide free emergency contraception to women who are victims of rape. Many in the conservative Catholic hierarchy believe the morning after pill to be a form of abortion. Indian police suspect sabotage is behind this afternoon's train accident that left at least 65 passengers dead in the eastern state of West Bengal. FSRN's Bismila Gilani reports.
The incident happened about 90 miles from the West Bengal capital, Kolkata. A passenger train derailed and was rammed by a freight train racing down the adjacent track. The collision left at least 65 dead and more than 200 others injured. Authorities are not yet clear whether a bomb blast or the removal of a portion of the railway track caused the derailment. But they say it's an act of sabotage by the Maoist rebels. Bhupinder Singh is Director General of West Bengal Police.
We found posters issued by a Maoist front group owning up to the attack. Other information we are getting also makes it clear that the Maoists are responsible.
But the rebels have not yet claimed any responsibility. The Maoist insurgents, who say they represent the rural poor, have intensified attacks against security forces in recent months, but they generally do not target civilians. The government has ordered a high-level inquiry into the incident. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News.
The death toll in Jamaica continues to rise as authorities continue to find people killed in this week's violence in the capital, Kingston. More than 70 people, mostly civilians, died in clashes between security forces and supporters of suspected drug lord Christopher Dudas Koch. The U.S. is calling for his extradition, but Koch is still at large. Amnesty International today called for an investigation into human rights violations during the siege. In California, advocates of marijuana legalization for all adults have gained a powerful ally. A major union has started to organize medical marijuana workers. For FSRN, Kelia Ramirez has the story.
The 26,000-member Local 5 of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in San Jose is organizing about 100 cannabis industry workers in Oakland. A union organizer told the San Francisco online newspaper SF Appeal that he believes this to be a first in the U.S. or Canada. Marijuana advocates see the unionization bid as legitimizing efforts to legalize and tax marijuana. California legalized medical marijuana in 1996. An initiative on the California ballot this November would legalize possession and use of small amounts of marijuana by anyone over 21. Passage would create a growing pool of dispensary workers, cannabis processors, and agricultural workers for the union, whose membership, mostly grocery workers and retail clerks, declined by 5% last year. The national union has not officially endorsed the initiative, but could do so in July. Kelly O'Ramaris, FSRN, Oakland, California.
And finally, the EPA has settled with environmental groups and will now increase the monitoring of pollution from factory farms in the U.S. Groups like the Natural Resource Defense Council say factory farms regularly store animal waste in large lagoons that often burst or overflow, sending tons of material into waterways. In this week's settlement, the EPA says it will launch an investigation into factory livestock farm practices, identifying their locations, number of animals, and their methods for storing waste. The original Bush-era rule gave the farms exemptions from some clean water standards. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thanks as always to FSRN for those headlines. We look forward to having fresh headlines from FSRN 1 week from today on Monday. We turn now to headlines from a more local source. The Thai's Colleen Kimmett joins me over the phone to talk about some of the most recently published articles from the Independent online magazine. So first of all, thanks so much for joining us, Colleen, and I hope that today we won't be hearing the sounds of trains and whatnot going on behind you. I take it you're in the office. Colleen, are you there? Oh, sorry, we're just going to take a quick break. I guess we've lost Colleen in the process, but hopefully she'll be back and we'll be able to address some of the most recently published articles on the Thai, including what's happening in Canada following the BP oil spill off the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. We'll just be a few seconds as we figure out these technical complications.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
The Seed Productions Foundation is proud to present An Evening with Deepak Chopra. On the heels of two new releases, the New York Times best-selling author Deepak Chopra will bring his message of well-being to Vancouver on June the 4th. Dr. Chopra is acknowledged as one of the world's leaders in mind-body medicine and has been described as the poet-prophet of alternative medicine. He will talk about his latest works, Reinventing the Body, Resurrecting the Soul, How to Create a New You, and the ultimate happiness prescription, the 7 keys to joy and enlightenment. An Evening with Deepak Chopra at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre, Friday, June 4th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets online at ticketmaster.ca.
And when we experience that, you'll be extremely ecstatic. You'll be extremely joyful because this is the real you. And that he calls Nirvana.
Welcome back to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building. And if you needed proof that we are live broadcasting, we just had some technical difficulties as we were trying to connect with Colleen Kimmett. And hopefully, Colleen, you can hear me now and we can hear you.
Hi.
We can hear you. Okay. Good to hear. Sorry about that.
No problem.
So to start things off, the top kill operation that BP undertook this past weekend to begin addressing the oil spill into the Gulf of Mexico was yesterday declared a failure. And with limited options, it's safe to call that Gulf oil spill a major American crisis. So we want to hopefully today look at how far that stigma of an oil spill will reach. And this past week, a few of the TIES articles have addressed these types of environmental questions. So, Colleen, can you tell us a little bit about some of the recent stories from the TIE about environmental safety regulations? To start, Mitchell Anderson wrote today about some immediate concerns for British Columbians. So what would an oil spill mean for our province?
Well, it could be devastating, and it seems that... can you hear me okay now?
We can hear you. We just have a little bit of feedback, and I apologize. That's just our old equipment here at the University Station.
Okay, yeah. I mean, especially considering that the provincial government is supporting a plan to build a pipeline across the province from Edmonton to Kitimat that would carry oil and bring a lot of tanker traffic to the coast. It's a big issue for British Columbia. And Mitchell Anderson's report brings to light some of the regulatory concerns around this. After the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989, the federal government created 6 advisory councils. So these are independent panels comprised of local experts whose mandate is to advise the Minister of Transport on oil spill preparedness and response. So if something were to happen, are we ready for it? Can we handle it? So the Pacific Regional Advisory Council on Oil Spill Response is mandated to be a watchdog, essentially, for marine oil safety and communicate with the public on their findings. Given the support for this pipeline, which would result in more tanker traffic, in light of the Gulf spill, increasing concerns about these kinds of emergencies, you'd think this board would be a good thing, a given. But late last year, as Mitchell Anderson uncovered, Transport Canada started dismantling the board that serves as a watchdog for oil spill safety and preparedness. They limited meetings to just 2 per year. Members were denied access to drafts of changes to marine oil safety regulations that are in the works. Members were denied a modest travel budget to engage communities about increased tanker traffic on the BC coast. And according to one member of the council, these moves appear to be because the board had become, in his words, a burr in the saddle for Transport Canada. He said, it's quite clear they're not going to give it a budget, they're not going to allow you to have more meetings, and they didn't want anybody howling, so they got rid of most of the members. Now, this member, who says he does not speak on behalf of the board, believes that other jurisdictions have recognized that vigilance around tanker traffic requires public engagement and transparency, and that's not happening here. So
this sounds a lot very similar, actually, to another article that was on the TIE recently, one from Jeff Dembecki, who is looking into a bit more of a federal case. Maybe you could kind of compare what's happening in Canada in terms of provincial versus national, because Jeff had highlighted Canada, the federal government, rather quietly gutting environmental assessment laws. Is that right?
Yeah, the Tories introduced big revisions to the Environmental Assessment Act just months before a review of the Act is supposed to take place. Bill C-9 was tacked onto the Conservatives' budget bill earlier this year. So that means that the opposition couldn't vote it down without voting down the budget and triggering an election. Proposed rules under Bill C-9 would grant the Environment Minister the power to reduce the scope of reviews and put many infrastructure projects on an exemption list. Now, while Environment Minister Jim Prentice claims that the environmental assessment or the EA process is fundamentally the same, critics argue that the changes will turn the Act into hash, that it's undemocratic, and in the words of federal Liberal energy critic David McGuinty, these changes are guided by a hidden mandate and are driven by money. So Jeff Dembecki, followed the money. He tracked down some lobbying records for a firm called Global Public Affairs. Their client list includes Shell and the Canadian Energy Pipeline Association, which represents many of the players in the oil sands. And according to these records, for lobbyists, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act is a major area of interest. They've sought to enhance and streamline the assessment of pipeline projects. And federal records show that Encana, another corporation with interest in the oil sands, lobbied in relation to the policy for cumulative effects assessment and management. So this cumulative effects is a major area of concern for critics of the revisions to the EA Act. They're worried that the changes will change the scope for the environmental assessment process, so that cumulative impacts of a project, especially a huge project like those in the tar sands, won't be addressed. What's more, Dembecki noted that the move blindsided a regulatory advisory committee that was formed in 1992 to advise government on the Environmental Assessment Act. In 2008, the group's activities came to a mysterious halt. First, one meeting was postponed and then put off again. And one member of the committee said she wasn't even sure if it officially existed anymore.
So obviously these are very rather disconcerting patterns that are happening across provincial and national politics in terms of how our leaders are handling what any type of regulation around the environment, especially because we are seeing such devastating effects of what's happening off the Gulf of Mexico, because it's not something that can easily be fixed, as we saw with the Top Kill. It's something that failed miserably, and now they're trying something else, and scientists are saying that even won't be the end-all be-all. So it is rather disconcerting, and I'm really happy that the TIE has been able to highlight these stories. Aware of, unfortunately, our time constraint because of these technical difficulties we had earlier, I want to jump now to a story that was recently published on the TIE. It relates to something that we spoke about 2 weeks ago. You brought us a story from Katie Hislop about the Ministry of Children and Family Development. I guess Katie had spoken with former workers who remarked about budget constraints and heavy workloads at the ministry, and Andrew had asked you whether or not the ministry had responded to this. So now Katie has followed up on that story with an interview from Child and Family Minister Mary Polack. So can you tell us a little bit about what Katie's conversation with the minister was like?
Yeah, well, I mean, Katie asked, for example, why hasn't the ministry hired on more than 17 new frontline worker positions since 2001? Why isn't the ministry replacing workers who retire, quit, or go on leave? And the minister's answer was, well, it's hard. She said, this is not an easy job, and we are doubly challenged because we have many rural and remote areas. So she did say, though, that she wants to stick with the job. There have been three different ministers of this children and family development since 2006, and Pollock indicated that she wants this job, she wants this ministry, and she's here for the long run.
So it sounds a lot like, Honorable or Mary Pollock was saying, was rather... she was hoping that she could keep her position. She was acting politically, and she was just trying to defend her post. But was she really getting into the substantial questions that Katie was asking?
Well, she stood by her previous assertions that recommendations, the Hughes recommendations, and just to backtrack a bit, a former judge, Ted Hughes, conducted a 2006 independent investigation into BC's child welfare system. He made 62 recommendations, and Minister Pollack and the provincial government, they stand by their assertion that all of those recommendations have been implemented, despite the child welfare watchdog and Hughes himself saying, no, they haven't. So I'm not sure how you can, it seems like a dead-end argument, yes, no, back and forth. But the good thing is that the watchdog, Mary Ellen Terpelafond, who is the government-appointed representative for children and youth in the province, is currently producing a report on the status of those recommendations. So perhaps when she does, compile all of her research and release that report, maybe the ministry or the provincial government will be forced to reconsider their position that all the recommendations have been implemented.
And I hate to gush, but that is the great thing about the TAI, is that you are able to follow up on these stories, and we can have these memes where we can come back to you in a few weeks and we can see what's been any developments on these issues. So I really do look forward to speaking with you again on Monday, and maybe we can follow up on what's happening in the environment or local politics. But thanks again, Colleen, for joining us today on the show.
You're welcome.
So that was Colleen Kimmett from thetai.ca. And for more on all these stories, please visit thetai.ca. That's thetyee.ca. This past week, News Director Andrew Longhurst started looking into the projected $1.1 billion security costs for the upcoming G8 and G20 meetings in Ontario later this month. To address this figure, Andrew spoke with MPs from the opposition parties who have been on the front line of this debate.
Many Canadians are still shocked about the security costs of hosting the G8 and G20 meetings in June, as the costs are expected to top $1 billion. The G8 summit runs from June 25th to June 26th in Huntsville, Ontario, in Canada's Muskoka region. Following the G8 summit, Toronto will host the G20 from June 26th to June 27th. $160 million was originally budgeted for security, but has since jumped to $1.1 billion. The Conservative government has been on the defensive, and Public Safety Minister Vic Taze has continued to defend the now $1.1 billion as a necessary expense, even though other host countries have provided security for far less, even less than $100 million. On Thursday, May 27th, I spoke with Mark Holland, the Liberal opposition critic for public safety, as well as Don Davies, the NDP opposition critic for public safety. In the days since I spoke to both Mr. Holland and Mr. Davies, Auditor General Sheila Fraser has said that she will look into the spending for the summits, following requests by both Mr. Holland and Mr. Davies. First, here's an exchange between Liberal MP Mark Holland and the Parliamentary Secretary for Public Safety, Dave McKenzie, speaking on behalf of Minister Vic Taze from May 28th's question period.
The Honourable Member for Ajax Pickering.
Yesterday, the government invoked 9/11 to try to justify spending 300% more than any summit ever held in history.
Since 9/11, there have been 11 summits, including London, England, who just last year were able to hold their summit for 5,000% less. They did it $1 billion cheaper. Using the word security isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card. You can't use it to avoid accountability. How did the government allow this summit to become by far and away the most expensive meetings ever held anywhere in history?
Well, Mr. Speaker, since the tragic events of 9/11, increased security has unfortunately become a fact of life. Security costs money, and we are hosting two international events back-to-back, which is unprecedented. Mr. Speaker, all the costs have been budgeted for and are on target. As we have seen with the Ottawa firebombing and the damages in Toronto last night, events like the G8 and G20 meetings, they attract thugs and other fringe elements that are desperate for attention. Canada, as host of the G8 and G20 meetings, has to be prepared to respond to any possible situations or threats to our guests, and that's exactly what we are doing.
The only thing unprecedented is the cost. I said there was 11 summits, all of them incredibly cheaper. In fact, London was 5,000% cheaper just last year. Clearly, this government doesn't get it. We're in a recession. Thousands of Canadians don't have a job. The Conservatives have run up the biggest deficit in Canadian history. We can't afford a $1 billion binge on 72 hours of meetings. Now the public safety minister says, quote, the costs are very expensive, and questions of, quote, these types of meetings are necessary. Why on earth did he not ask any questions before he signed off on $1 billion?
Well, Mr. Speaker, Canadians were shocked last week over the firebombing of a Royal Bank in Ottawa and the damages last night in Toronto. Prime example of why we need to be prepared to face thugs who would threaten our safety. We are on track to host a safe and secure G8 and G20 summit. Our security plan has been developed and costed by Canada's best experts in the field, and it is budgeted money. We're honored to host this world's most influential leaders at the summits this June. And unlike the Liberal leader who has said that he is ashamed of Canada, we are proud and ready to showcase Canada on the world
stage. The issue is not security. It's incompetence and mismanagement. This government says they can't afford improved DI benefits for breast cancer survivors. They tell police and firefighters there's no money for the families of those who died in the line of duty. They tell those who lost their job that in this recession that they don't have the budget to help. But they have $1 billion to spend on the most expensive 72 hours of meetings ever held. Will the government just admit that their mismanagement, their poor planning, and their attempt to stick these meetings in a cabinet minister's riding has stolen $1 billion away from priorities Canadians care about?
Mr. Speaker, just because a member says it doesn't mean it's true.
Here.
Canada is honored to host the world's most influential leaders at the G8 G20 summits this June. The G8 and G20 summits are major events, and hosting these summits requires complex security planning to ensure we're prepared. The priority with all events of this importance must always be the safety and security of Canadians, participants, and our visitors. We were successful in hosting a safe and secure Olympic Games that Canadians can be proud of, and we will ensure the summit security is as effective and as well-managed.
I first asked both members of Parliament why the costs are at $1.1 billion. First, here is Mr. Holland.
Well, we know it's $1.1 billion so far. I mean, that's just what the government's telling us. I think there's going to be more costs to come. And it got here because of incredibly bad mismanagement. They tried to stick this thing in a cabinet minister's riding to reward the cabinet minister, then found out that that cabinet minister's riding couldn't handle it, that the event was too big to hold at the location they were trying to shove it. And so then they had to dump half of it at the last minute into Toronto, the nation's largest city, in a security nightmare. And so that's just taken the cost incredibly out of control. And if you put this into contrast, I mean, if you really juxtapose this against reality here, the last G20 was 1/20th this cost. It was literally 2,000% less expensive than this summit. In fact, this is the most expensive summit ever held anywhere at any time anywhere in the world.
And that summit, the G20 in London, which I assume you're referring to, is $30 million.
$30 million, yeah. And they did it for literally one-third the cost And that was an expensive summit. I mean, London, to be frank, is more expensive than Toronto. And what are we doing holding it in Toronto in the first place? You know, and particularly, and this is the real irony here, and it would be funny if it wasn't us that was on the bill for this ridiculous amount of money. This is a meeting about austerity. I mean, we're hosting the world for 3 days, not even the world, a few of the world leaders, for them to come together to talk about how we can cut our deficits and how we can spend less and be more responsible as governments. And we're hosting it at the biggest price tag by 300% that's ever been spent. So why on earth did we not choose one venue in a remote, secure location? We have several of them in the country that could have held it. And we could have spent literally a fraction of the amount and, in fact, told people to bring less staffers, bring less policy people, and really set an example and bring it in, you know, as one of the least expensive summits.
I also asked NDP MP Don Davies why he believes security costs are at $1.1 billion.
Well, that's a great question as to how we got here. As a matter of fact, yesterday I wrote the Parliamentary Budget Officer, Kevin Page, and requested that his office launch an investigation into this, and I just found out about an hour ago that, in fact, he will do so. Main problem is we don't know how it got to such an outrageous amount. In March, the government tabled estimates that had the figure of $179 million for security for the G8, G20 meetings. And for your listeners, that's only 3 days of meetings. They overlap on the middle day, so it's really 72 hours of meetings. And the government earlier this week tabled supplementary estimates that added over $640 million to it, resulting in a total of $830 million. That happened on Tuesday. So I questioned the Minister of Public Safety on Wednesday, and he then inflated the cost to $930 million. So it's basically quintupled in 2 months for and basically exceeded what we spent for the entire Olympics. So something's wrong.
I asked Liberal MP Mark Holland if he had a breakdown of the $1.1 billion, something Minister Taze has largely refused to provide.
Well, what we're told is that a lot of this money, close to $500 million, is going to the RCMP. But I mean, even if you were to spread that to every officer, it works out to be well more than $10,000 an officer. So, I mean, you know, I don't see how the costs add up. I really don't know where they're dumping this money. I mean, right now, of course, because they've stuck it in Toronto, you now are sending these RCMP officers to stay at hotels and eat in one of the more expensive cities in Canada. You're not able to set up sort of a separate tent where they can eat or a separate facility where they can stay. Instead, now we've got them staying in these extremely expensive places. But even when you add that up, I mean, that doesn't bring me anywhere near to $500 million. So we've asked the Auditor General to review these costs, to give us you know, a probing of what the heck's going on here, because it just doesn't add up. It doesn't make any sense.
With Vancouver Games activists targeted and intimidated by police and the Integrated Security Unit, I asked both members of Parliament if they had concerns that some of the $1.1 billion was going towards surveillance of G8 and G20 protesters. First, here's Mr. Davies.
Well, I'm always concerned, and my party, the New Democrats, are probably the lead party in the country in terms of being concerned about Canadian civil rights and protecting the rights of people to, you know, assemble peacefully and protest and make their views known. You know, these kind of events, the international political gatherings, have a history in Canada of being particularly questionable. We saw in Quebec a few years ago the Sûreté du Québec going undercover and trying to and posing as provocateurs. So there are definitely, we have to be vigilant about that, and who knows if there are costs embedded in this $1 billion that are targeted at activists.
And now, Liberal MP Mark Holland. Now in Vancouver during the Games, activists and anti-Games activists were, a lot of them were targeted, and also private visits were made by RCMP and members of the Integrated Security Unit about their activities during the Games. And there have been reports similarly in Toronto about activists having private visits from RCMP and ISU officials. Do you have concerns that some of this money is being spent on this type of surveillance?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a fair question. And, you know, that's a line we have to be very careful of. Of course we want to keep world leaders safe. Of course we want to have proper security. But if that money is being spent to curtail the rights of individuals just to express an opinion or to peacefully protest, then that's a grave concern. And because then you're starting to really attack personal freedoms that I think every Canadian holds very dear. We live in a free and democratic country. If somebody wants to express an opinion, they should be able to do that. And we don't want to live in a police state where if you have a different opinion than the governing party, you're not allowed to open your mouth.
Finally, I asked NDP MP Don Davies if he felt that the G8 and G20 summits are actually necessary and whether these dollars are better spent elsewhere.
You know, I'm a little bit of two minds on that. You know, Canada is a member of both groups, and they do rotate the meetings. So, you know, I think Canada has an obligation internationally to host these meetings. So in that sense, I think Canadians are happy to take our turn to host these meetings. On the other hand, not for $1 billion, particularly in an environment where people are tightening their belts, we're in a recession, students are struggling, seniors are struggling, the unemployed are struggling. I think there's alternate ways for leaders to meet than to have a billion-dollar meeting so the Prime Minister can have a photo op. You know, Jack Layton, my leader, did he costed out what we could do with $1 billion, and we costed out that 189,000 undergraduate students could receive their full funding of their tuition this year. So if you ask me on priorities, would I rather have 190,000 students have free tuition this year across the country, or would I rather have a three-day meeting that they could accomplish by teleconference? I'd go with the funding the students.
Until an audit is conducted by Auditor General Sheila Fraser, we will not likely know exactly how these $1.1 billion are being spent. For CITR News, this is Andrew Longhurst.
And thanks to Andrew for that story. The current time is 5:38, and that means it's time for your weekday weather forecast. And today's weather forecast was prepared by Daniel Casanova on behalf of the UBC Storm Club. Expect rainy conditions throughout the week with a chance of seeing some sun on the weekend. Daytime high temperatures will hover around 16 and 17 degrees throughout the week. There will be a 60% chance of showers tonight with a low of 11 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with 40% chance of showers with a high of 16 and low of 11 degrees. On Wednesday, expect rain with windy periods, high of 16 and a low of 12. For Thursday, expect it to be cloudy with a 40% chance of showers, high of 15. Low of 10. Friday looks a little bit better. Expect it to be cloudy with sunny periods. 40% chance of showers. A high of 16 and a low of 9. On Saturday, we will have a mix of sun and clouds. A high of 17, low of 10. And on Sunday, it will be cloudy with sunny periods. 40% chance of showers. High of 18, low of 11 degrees. And as always, tune in next week for your latest weather forecast right here on News 101. And a special thank you to Daniel Casanova for preparing today's weather. We're going to end the show today with this week's edition of Groundwire. Today it's addressing local, provincial, national, and international news, highlighting housing, Radio Free Palestine, and mining. That is all for today's show, all for today's edition of News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News, and you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program, and for more news, join us this coming Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Again, I'm Brad Pepink, and from the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. After Groundwire, you will be here on at CITR 101.9 FM with Phil for Career Fast Track. And as we said, here is this week's edition of Groundwire.
You are listening to Groundwire, grassroots news coverage from coast to coast to coast. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This week on Groundwire.
Every bit of green in our neighborhood makes a difference.
The whole plan was to displace these people by force.
And academia needs to ask these questions.
Plus, community reports from Radio Free Palestine, as well as the first annual regional community radio conference in Nelson, BC. But first, the headlines. A new common front for housing rights in Nova Scotia says housing is one of the most pressing issues facing poor and working people in the province. In recent community forums, activists, social workers, and community members have been building on the momentum created by the Out of the Cold Emergency Shelter to work together on common principles, including the universal right to quality, affordable housing. According to the Halifax Report Card on Homelessness, 1,718 people were homeless and stayed in a shelter in 2009. The report also shows that income assistance rent allowance for a single person with a disability is $535, while average rent for a bachelor apartment is $638. Cole Weber is an organizer with the Common Front and a social worker at Dalhousie Legal Aid.
We face a housing crisis in Nova Scotia, both in terms of affordability and quality of housing. Homelessness is increasing. Thousands of people live in substandard housing. Thousands of people across the province pay exorbitant prices and disproportionate amounts of their income for their housing. So that's why it's important that a housing coalition form.
The Out of Cold Emergency Shelter opened in 2008 as a direct community-led response to the closure of Pendleton Place, Halifax's only shelter of last resort. Staffed entirely by volunteers, the shelter operated out of St. Matthew's United Church from November to April, 7 days a week, providing 15 beds each night. The first association to make an academic discipline out of mothering has closed its doors. The Association for Research on Mothering, ARM, was housed by York University for the past 12 years until its closure in March. The center did not receive any York funding. Though the association published a popular research journal, hosted numerous conferences, and supported a feminist press, it had to raise its own funds through member fees, press sales, and grants from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. ARM also co-founded the International Mothers Network, now with 120 members worldwide, and co-founded the Museum of Motherhood. ARM supporters are left puzzled as to why ARM was shut out of even small-scale funding year after year. York University, for its part, alleges financial irregularities led to the decision to close the association. Groundwire filed an access to information request, but a recent gag order has prevented full disclosure. One of ARM's most recent projects was a large-scale research study called Mothering in the Academy, which looked at barriers mothers face in academia. Pat Brenton is a York PhD candidate whose research also centers on mothering identity. Pat was dismayed at ARM's closure and advocates more support for feminist scholarship.
I have to say, I was quite disappointed to see that ARM was cut. Mothering, it's certainly not kind of a primary area of research. I think that's part of the problem. So how come women and children in Canada are the poorest, right? What is that about? It's totally reflective of the larger society and how we value mothers, the work of mothering, and academia needs to ask these questions.
Down but not out, in May, ARM members launched the new Mothering Initiative for Research and Community Involvement with a literary gala on May 21st. See motherhoodinstitute.org. Some students, staff, and faculty at Mount Allison University do not want Indigo founder and CEO Heather Reisman to receive an honorary degree during the May 17th convocation ceremony because of her direct connection to the Israeli military. In 2005, Reisman and her husband Gerald Schwartz founded the Hasig Foundation, an organization that provides full academic scholarships and living expenses to former lone soldiers who have completed the service in the Israel Defense Forces and have chosen to make Israel their home. The university received emails from across the country, both in opposition and in support of Reisman. Several professors at the university also signed an online petition against the degree conferral. Though the attempts to have the decision reversed failed, and Reisman did receive the honorary degree, it has spurred a process of community engagement at the university, and many are now calling for a revision in how honorary degrees are awarded. May 17th was International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. Trans community activists and organizations gathered at Queen's Park in Toronto to support amending the Ontario Human Rights Code to include gender identity. The amended bill, or Toby's Act, would include gender identity as a prohibited ground of discrimination. While the Ontario Human Rights Commission recommended the inclusion of the gender identity in the code in year 2000, this is the third time NDP MPP Cherry DeNovo has brought forth the act. According to Susan Gapka, chair of the Trans Health Lobby Group, the delay in government response can be attributed to the lack of organizational support in the early 2000s and the proroguing of the provincial government twice, forcing the reintroduction of the bill several times.
Telling people we have an idea or there's something we want is one thing. It's a concept. But when we have a bill, it's much more tangible. But it also would say a clear, strong message to landlords, employers, people who provide services, that it's wrong to discriminate.
GAPCA says the amendment to the Ontario Human Rights Code would serve as a legislative protection from the discrimination that trans people often face. Meanwhile, a similar bill has been introduced to Parliament on May 10th, calling for the inclusion of gender identity and gender expression to the Canadian Human Rights Act. Gender identity is currently included on explicit grounds for human rights protection in the Northwest Territories, in several U.S. states, and in United Kingdom legislation. For our feature stories. From Montreal, Annick Babinski reports on Parc Oxygène. Created 20 years ago when residents took it upon themselves to convert a dangerous downtown Montreal alley into a green space, the years of success are now threatened. Norman Navrosky, a member of Montreal's Milton Park project, is raising awareness about a recent zoning change which will allow developers to build on the privately owned site.
20 years ago, residents of the Milton Park neighborhood in downtown Montreal took action for the safety and well-being of their community. After years of finding no municipal response to their requests to make a busy back alleyway safer for local pedestrians, residents dug up either side of the lane, brought in soil and trees, and named it Parc Oxygène. Since that day, the park, although privately owned, has been maintained on a volunteer basis by members of the Milton Park Project. It serves as a dog walking and social lunching area for all the well-established local residents, the people who work in the surrounding office towers, and the transient student population from nearby McGill University. All of this could soon change. Due to a recent rezoning of the site, Parc Oxygène's existence is now threatened by land developers eager to build over the greenery. Chris Betts caught up with Norman Narwaki, a member of the Milton Park Project. He's organizing the Summer Lovin' Festival, which will take place in Parc Oxygène every second Sunday this summer.
Come together with us in this park and let's keep this park green and let's keep this space our neighborhood space. So we're trying to raise the profile of the park and we're trying to let the city know that this many people support keeping Parc Oxygène and we want you to do something about that. So now we would like the current administration to take charge of the matter and to rectify the mistake that was made in the past, because the current administration is definitely pushing a green agenda. And as you said, our park has been green for 20 years. It's, you know, all citizen volunteer work that's kept it that way. So why can't you now come to our help and, you know, do something about it and legally right that wrong with the zoning change? We're just hoping that, considering the context today when the city of Montreal is talking more than ever about keeping Montreal green, making Montreal green, the Parc Oxygène is part of that plan. It's got to be. It's got to be. And the more green spaces like Parc Oxygène we have, the healthier this city will be. It's so obvious.
Vicky Tobayana, reporter for the McGill Daily, captured the city's response to the demands of those involved in the Milton Park project with a quotation from City Councillor Michelle Prescott. Prescott argued that the city does not have the budget to purchase the land, and that if they did, the city would be hesitant to set such a precedent. Quote, "We cannot buy all the small lands in Montreal and create parks, and if we do it for this park, then we will be asked to do the same thing for other areas, and we cannot afford that," said Prescott.
You can't really put a price tag on, as you said, a calm space in the middle of the city. We live in one of the densest neighborhoods in Montreal, with the La Cité high-rises all around us, and all the traffic that pours into the city coming down Park Avenue. It's one of the busiest streets in terms of delivering cars and moving people into the city core. Well, we suffer the pollution from all that, so every bit of green in our neighborhood makes a difference. And it's like, yeah, we need this to live.
The Summer Lovin' Festival in Parc Oxygène is occurring every second Sunday between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. from May 16th until August 8th. Music, theater, art, dance, and more are on the agenda. If you are interested in learning more about the rich history of struggle against gentrification in Montreal's Milton Park neighborhood, visit miltonpark.org on the internet. I'm Anik Adibabinski reporting from Montreal for Groundwire.
Welcome back. Mining companies are increasing their threats towards activists, academics, and writers. In addition to the deaths of activists at mines in El Salvador and Philippines this spring, mining giant Barrick Gold is maneuvering to muzzle any scholarship about its global holdings and environmental standards. A book that investigates the economic motivations that bring over 70% of the world's mining business to Canadian soil has been pulled from print due to threats of legal action by Barrick Gold. Amidst these unsettling conditions, community organizers and representatives from affected communities converged at this year's Mining Injustice Conference in Toronto. CHRY Radio's Annabelle Kuhl was there.
Mining Injustice, the second annual anti-mining conference, featured speakers from Latin America to Africa, to Papua New Guinea, to First Nations within Canada. Together, they shared successes, challenges, and strategies for environmental and social justice in the extractive industries, 75% of which are based out of Canada. Indigenous leaders from Papua New Guinea spoke on the destruction of the Porgera mine, owned by Toronto-based Barrick Gold. Indigenous communities in the Porgera Valley have had to face the environmental devastation of their land, forced displacement, and the burning of their homes on three separate occasions. In the lead-up to these actions, Porgera MP Philip Kikala established a state of emergency in an effort to restore peace in Porgera. However, according to Amnesty International, there is substantial evidence that the police acted contrary to their search warrants, and none of the safeguards required under international law were implemented. As a result of an international outcry, the community was able to get a restraining order on the government and Barrick Gold. Jethro Tulin, a leader in opposing the Porgera mine, explains.
But somehow we got the attention of the international NGO communities, and we actually had a court order, which is still pending now, restraining them from any further action. So those are the things that have stopped the illegal behavior. Otherwise, the whole plan was to displace these people by force, not on a sustainable way as they say it out in their books or in the media.
The conference took place as Bill C-300 is being considered in the House of Commons. Bill C-300 is the Corporate Accountability of Mining, Oil, and Gas Corporations in Developing Countries Act. The act would deny Canadian public investments to Canadian corporations found to be abusing human rights overseas. However, communities in Canada and Turtle Island, where those very companies are based, are still lacking in such protections. Clifton Nicholas, a Mohawk community activist, spoke about a proposed mine in Gonesatake and Oka, Quebec. The local native community is still dealing with the repercussions of the historic Oka crisis 20 years later. Meanwhile, Niocan, a Montreal-based mining company, is seeking to mine niobium, a mineral used in the military-industrial complex to lighten and harden steel.
Now you see, like, this isn't coincidental, you know, it's deliberate in the series of maneuverings on the part of the government and the neglect in the community. So what this mining project intends on doing is to destroy the water table. And they're clear about it. We have to. The water table will be contaminated because we need water to mine this mineral, and there'll be all kinds of toxic tailings that'll be attached to their mining operation.
5 years ago, an environmental assessment report by the Bureau d'audience publique sur l'environnement advised the Quebec government that the uncertain character of the mine water and its flow weakens, quote, any assessment of their effects. The report also noted that most consultation participants are, quote, very concerned about the mining project to which they did not consent, end quote. Clifton Nicholas explains the complex challenges that residents of Gonesatake currently face in opposing the Niocan mine.
It's quite interesting right now because we're at a juncture where the non-native farmers and then the people of Gonesatake are able to unify and come together to combat this company. There's a lot of farmers that don't want it to happen because it'll destroy their livelihood, it'll destroy their farms. So we have a lot of power behind that because it's at the stage now where they're on the cusp of getting it done. However, these non-native farmers are blocking it because they refuse to sell. But doesn't mean all of them, because there's some of them that say, well, if the price is right, I might sell. That's the glaring difference between the non-native population and the native population.
A major focus of the conference was on building support among participants for a stronger anti-mining movement globally. Activist Susanna Durange of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation emphasized the importance of solidarity in speaking about the resistance movement in the Peruvian Amazon.
And it's interesting what's happening there. They can't divide the people and their stand for no against the mines. And the river downstream from them, more and more people are starting to say we need to work, because they were massacred on June 5th last year, and there's a lot of post-traumatic stress and nobody in there doing any kind of healing. And with that post-traumatic stress, people are feeling like giving up and giving everything away. And so we need to defend them. We need to come together and make one solid alliance, north, south, and for the whole world.
For more information on anti-mining resistance movements, please visit solidarityresponse.net. For Groundwire, I'm Annabelle Koo, reporting from CHRY in Toronto.
On May 13th, seven community radio stations across North America joined the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem to broadcast Radio Free Palestine, a historic radio reflection of the Palestine Nakba, or catastrophe. Here are some highlights of the international radio collaboration.
Remember what happened in 1948. This is Radio Free Palestine, broadcasting on 62 years of dispossession and resistance. In 1948, 85% of the Palestinians living in the areas that became the State of Israel became refugees. More than 500 Palestinian villages were depopulated and later destroyed to prevent the return of the refugees. Today, there are over 7 million Palestinian refugees dispersed throughout the world, the largest and longest-running refugee problem yet unsolved. 62 years later, Israel continues to occupy and colonize Palestinian land through the construction of Jewish-only settlements and the wall in Jerusalem and the West Bank